Last week, Kirsten and I were on the mainland. We were all the way back east. We were in Maryland for most of it, celebrating my father-in-law's 80th birthday. While we were there, though, we decided to take advantage of being back east and spend some time in Kirsten's stomping grounds, Capitol Hill, where she was raised in Washington, D.C. And while there, we decided one day to go to the new museum that has opened up there, the History of African American. The Museum of African American History. Has anyone here been to that museum? If you get back to D.C., I highly recommend you take the time. It's a fascinating museum. You walk into it, and it appears to have three or four very large stories above ground. What you don't realize is there are three very large stories underground, and the bulk of the museum in many ways is underground, and it's set up in such a way so that as you go into the bowels of the earth, you go into the beginning of the history of slavery in our country, and the first level takes you through slavery to just past the end of the Civil War and the Emancipation Proclamation. The second story, the second level, still underground, takes you from that point in history to about 1968, Civil Rights Movement, the passage of the Civil Rights Act. And the third level, still underground, takes you from the late 60s to the presidency of Barack Obama. We went there for an afternoon. I didn't get past the first level in that afternoon. I rearranged my day the next day to go back to the museum. I never made it to the top three levels, the above ground levels, because then those levels are the ones that are not about history, but about celebrating the contribution of African Americans into the culture of our nation. I made it about halfway through the second level, and I was in front of a picture that was published, I believe, in Life magazine in 1961, and that was the point where the dam broke and the tears began to flow. And forgive me if they come again, it just hit me so very hard. The picture I was sitting in front of, and I was talking to Linda about this today, because Linda, as any of you know, was a freedom writer in 1961. She was one of those young people, black and white young people, traveling on the buses of the interstate bus system, doing what they could, because the bus systems were segregated to integrate the interstate bus system. As a year before, folks had been doing the integration of the lunch counters throughout the South, and before that, the city bus system starting in Montgomery and in other places. And there's this iconic picture that some of you may have seen of a Trailways bus in flames. And that Trailways bus was in flames because it had been set on fire by those who did not want the Freedom Riders to do what they were there to do. And that was the moment that the dam began to break and the tears began to flow, because the whole day before and that whole day that I was there, I was mortified and I was horrified and I was fascinated as I read and looked and saw a history that we do not really know. 12.5 million people, 12.5 million people transported as slaves from Africa to what was then the New World. Only 400,000 of them made it to what became the States. The first person killed in the Revolutionary War was an African American. In 1860, at the height of cotton, 60% of the national economy, not the economy of the South, but of the entire nation, was connected to slavery. 60% of the nation's economy was connected to slavery. We hear of the Nat Turner Rebellion. We hear of John Brown's revolt at Harper's Ferry. We don't hear about the number of other times where African Americans, in the middle of the worst part of slavery, if there is any worst part, were rebelling, were standing up for their rights. And nor do we hear about the way in which, when those rebellions were brought down, that the bodies were taken and they were put on the byways and the roads so that people could see those mutilated bodies and be told to understand this is what happens when you go against the way things are. Very akin to people being put on crosses and lining the roads into Jerusalem, those who would dare to go against the Roman Empire. And the pictures, and the pictures, the pictures that got me, the pictures of this African-American man who, in which his back you cannot see because it is one welt after another welt after another welt after all the beatings that they wear. The pictures of the lynchings of bodies, black bodies hanging from trees while white faces partied and smiled for the camera. The pictures and the videos of the dogs let loose on the protesters in Birmingham, of the water cannons, of the batons being used on people as they tried to move across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma. The picture of the burning bus. It hit me. It hit me so hard. And part of why I think it hit me so hard is I think about those sacrifices that were made for generation upon generation upon generation to try and move the needle just a little bit forward that we might be humans with one another. The tears hit because of the stories that are lost or told, the contributions that were never made because lives were snuffed out. The average lifespan for an adult slave in the South in the 19th century was 7 years past adulthood. That's it. 7 years and gone. Stories that we don't hear. And I think what hit me the most is that when I looked at those photos and I looked at the faces that were smiling while someone has been lynched in the back, and I looked at the people that were unleashing the dogs and the water cannons, they all looked like me. They all looked like me. And people like me, having their system under attack, under assault, the way that they knew that the world was supposed to be and was supposed to be ordered is under attack, and so they rage against that. They rage with sword, they rage with gun, they rage with law, they rage with decree, they rage with Bible, they rage with everything at their disposal to make sure that privilege and position and power is not shifted. And while I was having my foray into the Museum for African American History in Washington, D.C., there was a Senate confirmation hearing going on in the same city. Actually, it began the day that we left. And the drama that has been played out has already been mentioned in our prayers and everything else. A drama in which we know that midterm elections were always on the mind of this nomination, that Supreme Court cases in the future were always on the mind, and in which bodies and people and thoughts were really not being paid attention to, in which stories that were credible were being dismissed and incredulous stories were being lifted up to supreme truth. But what I saw when I looked at what was going on is I saw some folks who looked like me. Some folks who had an education as good as the education that I have had. And some folks mostly who share a Y chromosome in their body like I have. Who were there making sure, whether it be by rage, by indignation, by indifference, by dismissing, by mockery, that the position and the power that they hold would be protected. Would be protected. It is people who look like me, and we talked about this today in the adult ed class, that have enjoyed generations of privilege, generations of power, generations of position and possessions. And as Anne Lamont says, when we are asked to let go of things, it usually comes with a lot of claw marks. So a lot of claw marks. I'm convinced that the people that were in the process of making sure that which they knew to always be true would continue to be true. would have found themselves very comfortable 2,000 years ago in the Palestine that Jesus is walking around in. That too was a community in which men had even more position and prestige than we find in today's world. That too was a community where even not all, though men had that privilege, there were some that had even more power and possession. And as we've talked about before, in that time, 2,000 years ago, if you were not an able-bodied adult male, you had no voice. An able-bodied adult Jewish male, you had no voice, you had no stature, you had no recourse to anything that was done by you. And this would be women, this would be children, this would be slaves, this would be the infirm, the ill, this would be the stranger, the foreigner. None had voice, none had stature, only those who were men. And ironically, it was the men who interpreted the divine law, mediated the divine law, and interpreted the divine law, and found a way that, lo and behold, the divine law put them in their pedestal, in their place of privilege, and somehow justified all the rest of the traditions that everybody else excluded. And we have this image of Jesus, this image that we want to hold on to, of this very peaceful, very gentle, very nonviolent person. And we forget, particularly in the Gospel of Mark, where from the very first chapter, Jesus is a one-man wrecking crew against those positions of privilege and power and everything else, and particularly against the reality that one could possibly envision that a God who is defined by love would allow laws to represent that God to come down and therefore then exclude all but a few. And so Jesus, from the very first chapters of the Gospel of Mark, challenges that which is the way things are. And so if you are feeling right now, in these last couple of weeks, in these last couple of years, in these last couple of decades, whatever it may be, if you are feeling right now the need to stand up and have your voice heard, whether that be by vote, be by legislation, be by taking to the streets, you are in good company. It's what Jesus was doing, particularly in the Gospel of Mark. There was the power and the privilege and the possessions right in front of him, and he was standing up to it. So you're in good company. But understand this, that's not all that he did. And this reading that Danny gave to us is the best example in the Gospel of Mark. Because what we have here is this story where Jesus is in the home and all of a sudden the children are brought in and they are crawling all over him. And in fact, 2 weeks ago, I talked about this, the image from Mark chapter 9, where Jesus takes a child and places the child amongst the adults, and then after placing that child, embraces that child. And we talked about what it means to embrace, and the embrace being that of welcome and inclusion. It's the same verb that is now used about 20 verses later. That same verb for embrace. And it's not just a child, it is children. We have no idea, but we have images, don't we, of a whole bunch of children coming in for a hug. Coming in for a hug. And the disciples are dismayed by this, and they're trying to shoo them away, and Jesus says, stop. Let them come. And the children are symbolic of this point, of all those who are excluded. It could be the women that he says, let them come. It could be the infirm that he says, let them come. It could be the strangers, the foreigners, the slaves that he is saying, let them come. Let all those whose voices have been removed have voice. Let all those who have no stature have stature. Let all those who have been told they are of no consequence, allow them to have consequence. Let them come. And so in the midst of challenging the system as it is, Jesus also lifts up an alternative way. Because when you think about 2,000 years ago, the work that it takes to maintain privilege, to exclude most of all people, And you think about the work that it took to maintain privilege and to exclude all African Americans for hundreds of years and continues to this day, as if voices and lives don't matter, as if buses are still being burned and continues to this day. And if we think about what we saw over the last couple of weeks, and we saw people circling the wagons to make sure that the positions and privilege that they have, when you think of the energy that goes into that, Jesus offers an alternative way to use your energy. Instead of privilege and exclusion, how about welcome and inclusion? And he puts his arms out and he welcomes those children. And so for just a minute, I want you to close your eyes and I want you to have two different pictures in your mind. Picture number one is all the times that you have seen a world of exclusion, whether maybe it is right there in the times that Jesus is dealing with the men of that time, or maybe it's what you've seen in the last couple weeks, whatever it is, picture that exclusion and then picture the vision there of Jesus with the children, arms open and welcoming and including. And hold those two pictures. And now I want you to take the two of them and I want you to paint in your mind those pictures, but without creating images, just use brush strokes and color. And I suspect that if you're using brushstrokes and color for that images of exclusion and privilege, you're using bold, dark colors with slashing brushstrokes. And if you're looking at the picture of Jesus with the children, you're using bright colors and rounded strokes. The one that creates this harsh image and this one that creates this gentle and calming image. And if you were to do the same thing and do it instead of with color and picture, but to do it with sound, the sound of that exclusion is a discordant sound, or it's the melody being pounded out harder and harder and harder, hoping that the harder you push it, people will hear. And the sound of Jesus with that children is a sound of harmony and symphony and many voices coming together. Jesus offers this alternative. Offers this alternative in a world in which we see raging exclusivity, in a world in which we see us versus them, in which we see that those who have been in privilege for generation after generation are working hard to maintain that. Jesus offers an alternative vision. An alternative vision, the vision of welcome, the vision of inclusion. It's a vision that says that we can be something different, the beloved community, the embodied grace in our world. And he invites us into that community. Do what you need to do to make your voice heard, but do not let that be all you do. Create that welcoming community. I think about the communion that we are about to have and the elements that will come up here and the table that is set, the communion table that is set. And I think about the reality that in so many churches for so many generations, this table was not a table that was welcome to all. It was oftentimes a table that was welcome to just some. Perhaps it was divided by gender. Sometimes it was divided by wealth. Oftentimes it's divided by, do you have the right beliefs? We don't say that here. Right here, we say all are welcome to this table. All are welcome to this table. All are welcome through these doors. Particularly welcome are those who have been excluded. Those who have been marginalized, those whose voices have been taken away, all are welcome. And those are the right words to say. And the challenge before us is that journey from here to here. From the words that come out, that all are welcome, to the living out from our heart, from our spirit, of that reality. Of becoming that beloved community, of doing the hard work. Because let's be clear, Jesus invites all those kids, and it's somewhat chaotic. maybe joyful, but somewhat chaotic when you sort of throw your arms open and welcome everyone in. You got some stuff you got to work out so that you can just get through the day. It's a lot of work. But I'd much rather put my work into the work of inclusion than the angry, raging work of exclusion. And we have seen that all around us. It is time. It has been time for 2,000 years. It has been time for we, the beloved community, to join with other beloved communities and make ourselves a place of welcome.